Merhaba, and welcome to the Matrix Green Pill, where real people connect.
Hello and welcome back to the Matrix Green Pill podcast. I am your host, Hilmarie Hutchison, and today I am thrilled to have Rana Hajirasuli, the visionary founder of The Surplus, joining us. Rana's extensive background in petrochemicals, coupled with her passion for sustainability and innovative solutions, brings a unique perspective to our discussion on reshaping business practices for a greener future. Now, without further ado, let's hear from Rana herself. Rana, welcome and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Hilmarie. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Let's kick it off by asking you to please introduce yourself to our listeners.
So my name is Rana Hajirasuli. I am the founder of a climate tech startup called The Surplus, and I'm also doing my PhD in the same field of industrial sustainability at the moment as well.
Okay, let's go a bit further back than that. Where did you grow up? What was the dream when you were growing up? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I grew up in the UAE, so that made me really aware of how the climate was changing over the years. I became really passionate about preserving, especially our coasts. I spent a lot of time on the beach as a child, and I was very empathetic, and I always loved animals very much. So I think it was something that was always in me to understand how I could better serve my community. We were essentially guests here in the beginning, right? So my family were migrant workers, or now we call ourselves expats, I suppose. But still, to a certain extent, I always learned that it was very important to kind of respect the community that you're living in and also understand its values. And the values that were deeply embedded over here was always leave no trace behind. Even when the UAE was rapidly modernizing and growing, I spent some years away in Ireland. And my similar experience there was essentially a really wonderful, homely country that also got me even more passionate, zooming in on some of the technical understandings of what sustainability is. I spent some time working at a civic engagement biomarine research unit. And that really put things into perspective in terms of how coastal erosion is actually affecting people and their communities. I brought some of that learning back here. And essentially, I started building up my business and work-related experience and not taking the full leap until I fully understood the problem.
You've been passionate about the environment since you were a child. I believe that you organized the UAE's first beach cleanup at the age of 6, demonstrating your lifelong commitment to environmental change. How have these early experiences shaped your journey?
When I was younger, I went to a school in Sharjah, actually, and I always kind of knew, I guess I was a little bit quirky, perhaps a little bit different. So I decided to organize the first beach cleanup. I think what perhaps I would feel that I'd be able to kind of explain a little bit better is, you know, growing up a bit later, I found out that I was on the autism spectrum. I started to understand a little bit more about why I was very passionate and very empathetic. So I felt that a lot of the time, you know, other people's pains were my own to take on as a burden. And I feel these things quite deeply. So I guess growing up, becoming a little bit more mature, gaining that commercial acumen, getting some years of experience under my belt, I got a better scope and angle of the type of sustainability that's important for me, the angle that I wanted to focus on. Because of course, when you're younger, you want to do good, but you don't exactly have that high level understanding of how to actually contribute and in what way. Looking back down the line, I think the form of leadership that I'm quite passionate about will be servant leadership, essentially putting our community or your community and the people that are around you above your own needs and above your own agenda is something I'm quite passionate about. And I think that's something that wasn't learned. It was always in me.
Can you tell us more about your journey and what inspired you to create The Surplus in 2022?
I had quite a diverse work experience. So I was firstly working at this biomarine research unit in Ireland for a while. So I spent a lot of time on the coast and I started to understand how important civic engagement is. So how much are people within a certain community invested in protecting the shorelines or their beaches that they're living just nearby, right? Or how committed are they to picking up plastic, for example? So I got the real people-centric approach. Then I worked in legal for a while. Then I came back to Dubai and worked for a petrochemicals manufacturing company, which is not as fancy as it sounds, actually. It was an SME. Over that time, just before COVID hit, I started to realize realized that there's a real problem for SMEs coping with climate change. So I really started becoming fascinated about what this looks like on a macro level. I found out that SMEs actually make up more than 90% of our global economy, but all the resources related to sustainability, I found out, was designed for much larger companies, despite them being really affected by climate and supply chain shocks. So essentially, they were disproportionately affected. So once I zoomed in a little bit closer on this problem, I found out that this was not just something I was facing at work. There's a lot of work that could be done to equip SMEs better to manage their resources and also make a profit out of it, because I felt that there was a real gap in terms of what SMEs could do and what they could afford to do. So I really wanted to close that gap.
What exactly is the surplus and how does it help SMEs?
The surplus is a B2B sustainability exchange that helps companies firstly map out their underused resources in terms of their assets, the waste they're producing, all the yucky, boring, depreciating things that are on the books, such as extra warehouse space and so on and so forth. All of these resources actually cost companies a lot of money, but they don't actually know that this could help them become more resilient towards the climate in terms of addressing what they have to reduce their emissions. And secondly, they don't have a real platform for them to be able to share these resources with other companies nearby. So we help essentially close the gap between climate science and the circular economy. So a super simple example of this would be a company has, again, extra warehouse space. They produced a lot of byproducts. They're left short with a bunch of stock they ordered for a sales order and it fell through. So they have all of this kind of idle stock that's sitting around and they don't know that that's a real opportunity for them to make money, but also sell it out to other companies. In short, the surplus essentially helps companies close this gap and make more profits from this while substantially reducing their greenhouse gas associated with occupying physical space in terms of energy and also reducing the amount of materials that they require to manufacture these products.
An amazing solution. You saw a problem and then you created a solution for that. Leveraging climate tech is a key aspect of the surplus. Could you explain how this technology plays a role in promoting sustainability and resource sharing?
Yeah, of course. I think that the climate tech aspect is very interesting because there's a very small gap within the climate tech space that looks at industrial management and resource management. And most of the climate tech startups you may meet, they're mostly in the kind of carbon offsetting space, or they're within nature-based solutions or electric mobility and EVs. We thought that there would be a real opportunity in terms of leveraging digitization as a tool to accelerate the industrial climate action. More than 31% of global emissions are actually caused by the stuff that we use every day. The stuff that we use every day, what lies behind that is these linear supply chains that are essentially quite damaging to the environment, as well as obviously the communities that they operate within. So we thought in order to really tackle the root of the problem, we have to make our way up through the supply chain. So the way that we looked at it was, yes, AI is being leveraged in many different ways right now, but what we're looking at is essentially tackling the root of the problem, which is actually organizational psychology. If we can help businesses make better decisions and we can create a machine learning algorithm around this to get them to prompt them to slowly start looking at alternative ways of doing business, they would fundamentally reduce their emissions. And that's how we're leveraging climate tech to help change the landscape that we see really needs a little bit of shaking up.
Yes, you mentioned reducing emissions, and I know that's one of your goals, and also, of course, to reduce the associated costs for businesses. Could you maybe share a success story or examples of companies benefited from your solutions?
We work right now with companies from multiple verticals, and some of the real low-hanging fruits we've seen recently is within the food space. We have small retailers and supermarkets and grocers that are not part of enormous chains. So that means they can't actually afford to hold and lose all of their stock as well. And they don't actually know a lot of the time that they're contributing to the greenhouse gas emissions because they're landfilling their surplus produce and vegetables and whatever other FMCG products they're stocking. Once we actually onboarded a few grocers, we saw this incredible synergy happen between a social enterprise in the UAE. They specialize in essentially feeding blue collar workers that are perhaps between jobs that are currently financially struggling at the moment. And a grocer saw an opportunity to reallocate some of their surplus produce well before the expiry date. So we saw in 1 month, 24,000 healthy, nutritious meals were made from surplus vegetables and produce. And we actually decided to really zoom in on this and see, well, if this is something that can happen within 1 month in a single synergy with two small companies kind of working together, how can we scale this So it can actually be replicated over and over again. So that's one kind of small success story that we saw that we were very pleasantly surprised that we didn't know the amount of waste that's actually produced, even in smaller distributors and vendors. We also saw some other, I suppose, hard to abate sectors. So these are the guys that essentially have a lot of construction and demolition waste that they would normally remove to landfill. They were working really closely with some other companies within the construction verticals, and they essentially found a new way to start creating construction materials from some of the waste. So that was some great success stories as well as some others, but I won't go on for too long.
Amazing examples though. And to see how one company's waste or became something that you could help people in need through another company. Fantastic example. In your opinion, what are the biggest barriers for businesses when it comes to embracing sustainability, and how does the surplus help overcome these obstacles?
I'll go with a macro level one, because no matter the company size, there's always resistance. So again, I'd say organizational psychology is the biggest problem. So there's always people that are resistant to change. And many companies seem to think of sustainability as something expensive. Climate change is not something that's affecting us at the moment. If it does, we'll let you know. So this is the type of feedback we realized initially. So of course, as a startup, we are designed for survival because we're fully bootstrapped. We had to go down the other route. We'll say, look, if you're not interested in climate, that's fine. But surely you must be interested in becoming a little bit more financially resilient. So that's when the conversation started changing. And we started to see how to overcome these conversations, these barriers, by changing the light a little bit in terms of focusing on the financials. But at the core, the psychology is still there. Companies still seem to think of sustainability as like a CSR approach or a one-off project, but it's not true. It needs to be, for it to be effective, and for them to really get the fruits of their labor and make that impact, it needs to be deeply embedded in the way that they're operating on a daily basis. So I think that's our number one challenge. On the other hand, how we're catering to it is trying to validate this by partnering with some governments and industrial parks and business parks where they can actually mandate it to their companies and say, look, this is a sustainability service that we're currently working with, and these are our goals, and this is how we're planning to get there together. So I think that level of legitimacy gives that trust and verification that's really needed, that yes, sustainability is a priority. It's coming from the top. And this is what we're doing to push and drive the momentum forward.
Yes. And as you said, it's so important to shift the mindset from it being just a one-off project, maybe once a year, to embedding these practices in the standard operating procedures for companies. The surplus is described as a global platform developed in the UAE. How do you see this platform contributing to global sustainability efforts?
The way we say global, it just means it's a digital platform that can be accessed anywhere, essentially. So that means it's not built necessarily for one context. So that means what we do here in the UAE can be an excellent case study for other countries and other clusters to replicate some of our efforts here. But in saying that, the concept that we're actually chipping away at is called industrial symbiosis. And that's this fantastic system that's been around for ages, born in a small sleepy town called Kalundborg in Denmark. What we really saw happen there was a group of companies came together and said, look, we've got a lot of waste. We've got a lot of energy. We've got a lot of materials. We're going to be setting up shop here for the next decade or so. We'd probably be wise to exchange some of this, bring down some of our costs, and reduce our environmental pollution alongside with it. This concept, unfortunately, hasn't been able to scale the way that it should have because it's still quite labor intensive. There's a lot of experts that's involved. It's very expensive. So our digital solution was kind of a response to that, to not make it only available for large companies, but get SMEs with even a low level or maturity of understanding of climate related subjects or climate related topics and all of the kind of keywords such as net zero that doesn't mean much for SMEs, get it to mean something for them and hold that weight. So what we're hoping to see is essentially companies can start joining clusters nearby them. Now our efforts are still quite early. We're only in the UAE and the UK at the moment, but we hope if we can make this kind of lighthouse project seem like an attractive prospect, really give that benefit for the companies, clusters will start emerging organically. And over time, honestly, in about 10 or 15 years, I hope that they won't need us anymore. It will become a normal part of their business, and that legacy is there, with or without us.
That's amazing. So you can see into the future, or hoping to see the global impact of the work that you are doing now. One interesting aspect of the surplus is that you utilize nature's blueprints in your designs. Can you unpack that a little bit for us? Did I say that correctly?
Yes, absolutely. So I took this incredible course on biomimicry during lockdown. I started getting fascinated with how nature solves for problems. So I came to kind of understand that I was looking at sustainability all wrong. And something that I learned during that time was carbon is not the enemy. And for many sustainability practitioners, it could definitely come as a shock, right? Because all we talk about is get rid of carbon. We have too much carbon. Carbon dioxide is the enemy. And so I started looking at things a little bit differently. I had a new toolkit to kind of look at this new world in a way that I hadn't before. So I started learning that what if carbon was not the enemy? What if we've just created too much of it at the wrong place at the wrong time, and it's a foundational building block for life? I started studying various ecosystems and organisms for my project, and I came across a very peculiar organism, which is actually called slime mold. Well, it's actually a family of slime mold. And much to my mother's dismay at our dinner time conversations, I was really fascinated by how slime mold leverages collective intelligence to find the quickest path for success. So I actually found this really interesting video online that these scientists tried to replicate the Tokyo Railway to see how efficient it was. So they actually placed some food around this little experiment area with slime mold, and overnight or over 2 days, it actually replicated the Tokyo Railway almost identically. So this shows that nature has 3.8 billion years of genius, and we would really be unwise to not tap into that. So the inspiration for the surplus actually comes from slime mold. And this is not something I talk about very often, because as you can imagine, we get a few weird looks here and there. But the collective intelligence of businesses and their collective decision making, whether they're successful in their synergies or not, can feed back into this loop of creating the quickest path for them to find that success when it comes to connecting with other companies nearby, creating this fascinating superstructure that we're seeing already, and this self-sufficient ecosystem that they can find everything that they possibly need just nearby them.
I love that. That's absolutely brilliant to look at nature and how nature solves, and then to replicate that or to find that. As a leader who champions industrial symbiosis and collective action for change, what advice would you give to entrepreneurs and business leaders seeking to implement sustainable practices in their organizations?
The main thing I would say is understand the problem really well. While there's a lot of, I think, professionals within this space that genuinely do mean very well, there is a distinct difference between expertise and passion. And unfortunately, that's given rise to an enormous wave of greenwashing, which is not doing, you know, anyone any favors. So I think for most of us, I give myself the same advice all the time. We need to be incredibly passionate about the problem and not jump the gun too much on short-sighted solutions.
I think that's good advice. Very good. Now we will switch over to our rapid fire section, our game show. We'll ask you some quick rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
If you could pinpoint one pivotal moment that ignited your passion for sustainability, what would it be?
I think the moment that I realized that more people have access to internet than nutritious food.
Wow. Okay. What is the biggest misconception about sustainable business practices?
That it costs a lot of money.
Yeah, I think that is a pretty common one. What is the best part of your day as the founder of The Surplus?
I think going to bed. I can't even lie about that. I'm just exhausted all the time.
Getting some much needed rest. If The Surplus had a mascot, what would it be?
I think it would be a penguin.
A penguin? Why?
I adore penguins, and it just gives me the feeling that I think The Surplus would look very fitting as a penguin.
What is one thing you do every day, no matter how busy you are?
Definitely stay active.
Thank you very much for playing along. That was easy enough. Now, before we wrap up, we'd like to do our Greenpool moment. Could you share an inspiring or life-changing experience that you have gone through, your Greenpool moment?
I think, honestly, mine was a little bit more of a tragic story that happened to me. When my father passed away suddenly, that's when a light switched off and I realized that sustainability means so many different things to so many different people. For me, it used to mean, how do we make things the way that we do today in terms of manufacturing? But later on, I realized it was really important to understand who gets access to what resources and when. And that was something I decided to commit my professional life to afterwards.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. Thank you so much for being here. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and you've highlighted some really important things for us to think about. I'm so sure that our audience is going to really enjoy this conversation. Before we say goodbye, could you please tell our listeners where they can find and follow you? And we'll also put this in the show notes.
Thank you so much for having me. Well, you can just go to thesurplus.com. That's with two S's, a surplus S at the end. And of course, we're on LinkedIn as The Surplus, and feel free to drop me a message on LinkedIn as well.
Again, thank you so much for being here today, Rana. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I wish you and The Surplus all the very best.
Thank you so much.
If you enjoy our conversations, please like and subscribe. See you next Wednesday.